Oh, I'll let you in on a little confidential item. I don't think it affects my bargaining position at all. Schwartz would rather market in the United States through an established agency. But if the conditions are unacceptable to him, then it's always possible for us to incorporate him, set up a distribution agency through people that are happy just to have the cotton burger without the formula, without any franchise except within their own local areas. And in the meantime, he's in full swing in Europe. And I just think we have to recognize that we're not really in much of a give and take position here. You've got something that you need, and if that's so, let's get down to basics.
Did you hear it? You've got something. He's trying to say, we've got something that you need. And he says, you've got something that you need, because he didn't know how to finish the sentence. Anyway, now we kind of pick it back up, and he's about to say the single most important thing he says in the entire negotiation, because he's about to go to work on the other side, and he wants to make it clear that they mutually understand what is about to happen. So listen intently to the next statement or two that he's about to make.
Let me indicate what I think are the essential items of any contract we're going to read. Without trying to say to you that you reject all of them, or any one of them, we can't continue to search this.
Okay, he says, let me point out what I think are the essential items of any agreement I think we're going to read, without saying that if you reject all of them or any one of them, that we can't continue to search it. So what is he saying? Remember, when we looked at the cooperative aggressive effective this morning, we said cooperatives are, they want to maximize this, but within the bounds of fairness, and that they are self-monitored. If I'm a cooperative, it's up to me to keep within the limits of fairness. And remember, the aggressive was just the opposite. And he's just clarified that. He said, we said that aggressives, the way they find the outer limit is to push as hard as they can push by every means at their disposal. And as long as you keep backing up, they assume that there is room to push. And so they're not self-monitors, they're other monitors. And he's just making it clear that's what he's about to do. He said, look, you know, let me lay out the terms of any agreement I think we're going to read, without saying that if you reject every one of them or any one of them, that we can't continue to negotiate. So he's saying, here we go. I'm taking off, and it's up to you to stop me. And if you stop me, fine. You know, that's what I'm here for, to negotiate. But if you don't stop me, sky's the limit. So he thinks he's made it clear. He said, you know, we understood that's what we're going to do, and now he's going to go to work on it. And let's just sort of see if you can feel there is literally a rhythm to the way these are going to flow, if you can feel the rhythm. Question. Thank you. The eye contact is abysmal, isn't it? If we replayed the tape, the eye contact by the cooperative was quite good up through his statement of the fact. And then as soon as the aggressive said, you know, I hate to see things break down right here at the outset, at that point, the cooperative started looking down instead of maintaining eye contact. So he must be, whether he's conscious of it or not, he's lost the good eye contact. And the aggressive seems to look down at the table some of the time, but he's got better eye contact than the cooperative. Okay, so the aggressive says, you know, here we go, it's up to you to stop me, and now see if you can feel the rhythm.
I want to put it into a context of a kind of an arrangement that Jones can live with and still protect Schwartz's interest. As I've indicated to you already, number one is no exclusive arrangement. And I'll temper that by saying, understand that if Jones is going to make a substantial investment, he's going to want to be able to capitalize on it. So let's say that Schwartz will guarantee to give his total production to Jones as long as he can take it. But if his production, and there'll be no limit on the amount that he can produce, whatever facilities he might want to establish, if Jones can't take it, then he's free to market it elsewhere. Now, there's another side to that coin. We don't want to give you just a pure requirements contract where you take all you want, but you don't have to take any more than you want. And we'd like to talk about, oh, say, in the neighborhood of 1 million quarts a year as a minimum.
Now, when we were on page 98, under Part B, it says, make extreme demands with the timing of the wealthy optometrist. And the way the wealthy optometrist does it is the client picks out a pair of glasses and says that they like, and says, well, how much? And the wealthy optometrist looks them in the eye and says, oh, that'll be $100. And then pauses and carefully observes the client. And if they don't flinch, she says, for the frame. And then, of course, it's $50. He pauses, carefully observes the client. If he doesn't flinch, he says, for that left lens, and so on. And that's just what we're hearing. The aggressive is throwing something out, but he doesn't punctuate. And maybe he's going to put a period, and maybe he's going to put a comma, but he carefully observes what effect it has or what he reads in the opponent. And so, and to do two or three of those is high-level skill. We just saw five in a row. Listen in your minds here. The aggressive says, okay, number one, no exclusive arrangement, pause. Looks over, see if that's going to stay down. It stays down. So he puts a comma and says, but on the other hand, Schwartz will guarantee to give his entire production to Jones as long as he can take it. Pause number two. Carefully observe the opponent. He writes that down. So he says, and of course, there'll be no limit on how much Schwartz can produce. If he produces more, then he's free to market it elsewhere. Pause number three. Carefully observe. He writes that down. So he says, and we don't just want to give you all you want without requiring you to take more than you want. So we're going to require you to take, say, and, you know, he's running out of things to say. And he wants to be sure and get it all. So he says the biggest number he can say of the straight face. He says 1 million quarts a year. And we'll hear in just a second how much Cottenberger in 1 million quarts a year. 1 million quarts a year. And the poor cooperative, he finally flinched. You know, his hand went up to keep his jaw from dropping open. But he wrote that down. And the poor aggressive didn't know what to do. At a minimum, he says, you know, you might even have to go more than that. So feel that rhythm. But the same cadence is going to continue.
You're talking now about the enzyme being contrasted with the...
No, my thing is that the enzyme, 1 quart of the enzyme will produce, 50 pounds of Cottenberger.
That's information that my client didn't give me, so I'll accept your word for that.
Well, you're talking about a vast fast food outlet, and you know McDonald's talks about in the multi-billions of hamburgers so far, and we're really talking about a fairly small percentage of the total number of hamburgers that are sold in this country, and I just indicate this as a minimum. If we didn't think your client would exceed that minimum, I don't think we'd be talking to him.
What was that figure again?
1 million quarts a year. And I'll get back to the question of price a little later when it becomes apparent that you're interested in a price on these terms.
Are you willing to agree, I take it then, that as long as we take a minimum of 1 million quarts per year, you wouldn't sell to anyone else within the United States?
don't think I said that, Dave. I said that as long as you will take our maximum production, we won't go looking for another cut. If we make more than 1 million quarts a year and you don't take it, and we want to sell it in the United States, we want to be free to do so.
Well, obviously, my client can't start from scratch with a product that's never been test marketed or accepted in this country and immediately gear up and go to 1 million quarts. We'd be talking about 50 million pounds out of 1 million quarts.
And that's 200 million hamburgers.
That's a lot of hamburgers.
Well, it's not really a lot in the market, in the national market. But let's talk about a phase-in. I'll negotiate with you on a startup rate. That's why I think that your 50,000 pounds of product is too small to start with, and you ought to be talking about 150. Let me go on. That's my first point. You heard what I said earlier about the formula itself. No disclosure to you and no disclosure by you if you happen to come into possession of it. And I would want liquidated damages on that. Well, the third point has to do with his services. I assume that this is essential. He's got to have Dr. Schwartz over here for an adequate period of time to train his own staff. I don't know whether Mr. Jones knows it or not, but Schwartz is engaged in some very important activities of his own. He is very interested in following up on an invention of a no-calorie ice cream. Contrast to the cotton burger, which he hopes to relieve the distress of millions in India and Nigeria and so on. In this case, he sees the United States as almost an exclusive market to people that want to eat without getting any nourishment, whatever. And he doesn't want to abandon that. That means that he thinks that he should be allowed at least 50% of his working time in the United States for his own research and development of his product. He also indicates, by the way, that 4 hours a day with him is about all that Jones's staff would need. What he is proposing is he come over here for 60 days. That he be provided with a laboratory of his own design and that at Jones's expense there be provided at least 3 graduate chemists as his assistants. And they're subject to his rejection, by the way. If he can't work with them, he wants at least one of them to speak German. As far as compensation is concerned, that's negotiable. But Dr. Schwartz thinks that is a small part of the total package here. And he's asking me to propose to you a fee of $100,000 plus expenses for himself and his family. That's travel and living expenses while here, which you've already indicated is no hang-up as far as closing this deal is concerned. I mean, the expenses, you haven't made any indication as to what the fee ought to be. I'll cover your point.
Does that pretty well cover your point, he said? And that, I believe, is the most important statement for our understanding by the cooperative in the whole negotiation. Because when he says, does that pretty well cover your point, it sounds to me like he's assuming those points would have come out just the way they did regardless of how he reacted when he heard the point from the aggressor. So it sounds to me like he's assuming that his role in this part of the negotiation is really a passive role, that he's simply there to receive information. And I believe if we asked him, he would say, well, you said this morning to learn the underlying interests and needs, and so I'm trying to understand the underlying interests and needs. And he cannot see what is so obvious to us, and that is that the point from his client's perspective were probably that size at the beginning of the negotiation. The point from Schwartz's fondest dream were probably that size, and the whole negotiation ought to be taking place within the boundaries of those inner rectangles. And he simply cannot see what we can see, and that is that his own failure to react to all of these outrageous demands has proved an irresistible temptation to the aggressive. And look what he's done. And so we see that the cooperative did exactly the predictable thing for cooperatives, and that is that he utterly lacks vigilance. He forgot to do what warriors do, and that is to establish some boundaries and defend them. And so he is underrepresenting the fact and underrepresenting his client in exactly the predictable way. How's the aggressive doing? He has done exactly the predictable thing for aggressives. He's got it going, and it has a momentum of its own, and he has utterly lost a sense of perspective or proportion. And he has overrepresented the fact and overrepresented his client. So that's what I mean when I say these two patterns, these two styles, bring out the worst in the other. No, not only do they fail to match up, they exaggerate the weakness of the other. And so we have it now to where the case has gotten clear out to these extremes, and the cooperative says, well, does that pretty well cover your point? And I know you want to hear the answer to that question.
Well, there's one other item. I hesitate to mention it in view of the prestige of Jones and his company. But here again, you have to bear in mind that we're dealing with a foreign national, and he's going to be out of his element. And he's heard a lot about American businessmen, the ugly American, and so forth. But he doesn't trust your client. For one thing, he doesn't agree with his politics. And if he weren't oriented strongly in the area of some fast money so that he can further his own research and so that he can move a lot of this cotton burger into underprivileged countries, I don't think he'd deal with your man at all. He regards him as a real reactionary. It all boils down to this. He wants some money up front. And I don't mean just good faith money. Let me come at it this way. Let's not try to settle this whole thing at once. Let's agree on a pilot project. You buy the required amount of cotton burger. You go out on a market test. And we'll give a reasonable period of time for Mr. Jones to accept the terms of a long-term agreement. An option, so to speak, for which he can pay some money. Now, Dr. Schwartz would not come to America until your pilot project was completed. And if he comes, it'll be on a contract for, say, at least 5 years. I don't mean for his own services. I mean on this purchase of this product requirement. And if he thinks he's got something, then we can proceed. I would think that the time he came to the United States, He would not only ask to have his salary, his fee paid in advance, but an advance payment for the first half year's requirement of the enzyme. I know what you're going to say. You'll say, well, how do we have any assurance that the product is even there or that it's even delivered? You can have your agents check the inventory. And verify that the product is there and will be earmarked and tagged for this contract. We just be very happy to see title passed to the product in Europe, and you can be responsible for getting it over here. I think that's about the size of it.
Well, let me respond to that, John. It seems to me that without commenting on your entire proposal, let's come back to the concept of acquiring an initial quantity to test market.
Now, let me pause here because the cooperative is now going to lay out some proposed terms. And there are two ways to look at it. He is assuming that the aggressive demands were all in good faith. And if you assume that, this is a very impressive set of proposals he is going to make. He would be doing on page 99 what we have under 2B there, that the cooperative established credibility and good faith by making unilateral concessions. That's part of what he'll do. And by seeking the highest joint outcome, where you dovetail the interest. And notice how neatly he put together, if you assume the good faith of the aggressive demand for a moment, how neatly he put together the interests of the two sides as he frames these. So in a way, it's very impressive. He just forgot to be vigilant because he shouldn't be doing this at all. But given that he is, notice he has a real gift for it.
Suppose we were to agree that we split the difference between the quantities we're talking about. And suppose that you and I endeavor to work out an agreement for our client that would contemplate the purchase, let's say, of 100,000 pounds of the cotton burger itself, at say 5 cents a pound or another figure we can mutually agree upon. And that this would be a firm commitment at this point to buy this on the understanding that we, subject to reasonable limitations, would test market this initial 100,000 pounds in the United States with an option on our part to enter into the long-term agreement that we're talking about at the expiration of, say, 90 days after the product is delivered to us. And that we endeavor to work out as quickly as we can before this purchase becomes effective the terms of the agreement on which my client, Mr. Jones, would have the right to go forward. If the test marketing proves satisfactory, if the product is sufficiently accepted, we would then commit at that point to either drop the deal or exercise an option. I don't have any objection to a 5-year contract as long as there's some limitations on the phase in of the purchases. Suppose that I really feel, however, that my client would require the services of Dr. Schwartz for a period of at least 5 or 6 months.
Okay, now at this point, the aggressive turns to the camera and says, the negotiation's over. That's as much as we can do. I would now go to the telephone. I would telephone my client, and I'd tell my client I could get everything or better than he asked me to get, except two things. And one is, I think I can't keep it at 3 months. I think we'd have to he'd have to stay at least 6 months. And I would tell him we're going to have to go ahead and give him the exclusive rights on the enzyme. Now, isn't that remarkable? Because the last thing he said was, tell me about exclusive rights. If that's go, no go. If that's important to you, let's stop, because I'm not even going to talk to my client about it. And then the next thing he says is, I call my client and say, well, we're going to have to give it to them after all. But, of course, the client had already given him away to start with. So it's a remarkable negotiation, because everything that would be predicted from the cooperative and aggressive pattern quite literally plays itself out. Now, how to debrief on this? I imagine you've got a bunch of questions and comments, and I've got a few. What questions do you have? What might we talk about here? Was the aggressive aware of what he was doing, or doing it unconsciously? I'm assuming that he was quite aware, because he did know the facts well. He had had 2 weeks to prepare. I talked with them, both of them, right after this negotiation. It seemed very clear to me that they knew what was going on. So my sense is that the aggressive wanted to show how much power he had and how much he was able to do in negotiation. Good question. Good question. The question is, did Jones' lawyer not know what had already been agreed to, because he seemed to sit there and take sitting down contradictions to what had previously been agreed to? And what these two lawyers got to prepare from was the case files. The files had the files contained the correspondence between the two sides. And the correspondence contained essentially everything that both of them knew. I think the only thing that the cooperative didn't know was that that Schwartz had 100,000 pounds on hand in Europe. But he knew that the exclusive agreement had been agreed to. He knew that the product was not selling in Europe. And yet, it's very baffling. Why would he sit there in the face of that knowledge and not react to what the aggressive was doing? Nice question. Did not having a flesh and blood client maybe make the cooperative less vigilant? I think yes. And in fact, in this like you, I've seen demonstrations. In fact, I videotaped negotiation demonstrations where you get a couple of really fine lawyers to come in and show how they would negotiate a case. In every case up until these tapes that I have seen, the two lawyers get together for dinner the night before, and they plan what they're going to do, and then they come the next day and they do it. Well, if you videotape them doing it, you miss the negotiation, because the negotiation was at dinner the night before. And we didn't want that to happen here. So what we did is arrange for them to come and negotiate, but we didn't let them know who their opponent would be, and we didn't let them communicate in any way with their opponent until we brought them in the table and sat them down. So they had no chance to take one another's measure. And that would make it a little dicier. In addition, I think here's the cooperative. Cooperatives believe that no one would stretch the truth. But if they were going to, they surely wouldn't do it on videotape. And if they were going to do it on videotape, surely they wouldn't do it at a university on videotape. And even if they're going to do it at a university on videotape, surely they wouldn't do it at a church-sponsored university on videotape. So my sense is he probably was lulled into a false sense of security. And I thought after the negotiation, he might get up and walk over and strangle me in the belief that I had set him up by giving different facts to the other side. But at the afterwards, he had no sense of having been betrayed or given too much. I think he hadn't yet seen what happened. What is amazing to me is that on videotape at a church-sponsored university, the aggressive did what he did. So clearly he had no inhibitions on it. It made me wonder, well, was he just playing? You know, did he go to extremes for the benefit of the camera? The only evidence I have on that is, 3 years ago, I taught a negotiation program for the International Association of Insurance Counsel. It's kind of an elite group of trial lawyers where someone has to die before the next person is invited in. And they were in West Virginia. Where did Congress build its bunker? Greenbrier, West Virginia. And I showed this tape. And I said, well, what grade would you give each of these negotiators? And I gave the cooperative a D- and the aggressive a D-. But they're fabulous by reputation, and they're sterling, but they went past each other in this negotiation. We broke for coffee break. Two lawyers in black suits came down. They looked like summons servers. And I thought I must be in real trouble. And they walked up to me and they said, we have a duty to tell you that the aggressive lawyer that you just did so poorly, he's the managing partner of our law firm. And my life passed before my eyes. And I said, well, what did you think? They said, you captured him perfectly. Because he runs meetings of the firm like that. It takes us 3 hours to do 15 minutes of work. Because that's his theory of motivation, that's how you get people to perform. So I'm assuming more or less we captured the aggressive negotiator.
This is the end of tape 5, side 1. The program continues on side 2.
So part of the question would be, if I'm hearing you, that you're seeing the patterns that are described on 98 and 99. And we might want to take just a minute and say, well, what are the risks then? What are the risks of using the aggressive approach, and what are the risks of the cooperative? And on 98, the middle of the page, we've got the dangers or risks of the aggressive approach. And one of them is to acknowledge it's a very difficult strategy to use effectively, that only one aggressive in four can manage it. And it's because it does have that life and momentum of its own, and you tend to take it too far. Secondly, it creates misunderstanding between the two sides, that they simply are going to pass and not know where each other is standing. Certainly, agreement is going to take longer and cost more if you're able to reach agreement. Third, it increases the number of failures, so that you're far less likely to reach agreement than with the cooperative approach. It also raised a strong likelihood of retaliation, that the cooperative would go home, figure out what happened, and come back, this time really loaded for bear. And, of course, we mentioned when you use it as a substitute for preparation, then it's not a very effective strategy. And also, it is not good at capturing joint gain. It destroys value rather than creates value. On the other hand, it avoids the risk of being exploited. You're never going to be too nice if you're using the aggressive strategy. And where it's a single issue negotiation, aggressive negotiators tend to make more money than cooperative. So there's kind of the trade-off with respect to that approach. Would the aggressive have made a deal here? Because if we do it just schematically, look to me, the aggressive got out to this point. In fact, he actually went a little further than that, because he said there are a couple of more points. So he goes clear out to the outer limit here. The cooperative came back and countered with a set of proposals that seemed to me to sort of meet halfway and tried to dovetail the interests of the two sides. He said, see, a quantity of cotton burgers important to you, we'll take double. We'll take 100,000 pounds if quantity is important to you. But price is important to us, so we'll pay at the lower end of what we were talking about. So you meet your quantity expectations, we keep it within our price range. That's a joint gain. Says, see, if you only want to come to 3 months, but you only want to work 4 hours a day, why don't you come 6 months? That's twice the time, but you only work half a day each day. And, that sounds to me like a pretty good dovetailing. And he says, we can't pay more than $1,500 a month, but we could We could put the money on deposit up front, so you'd know that you're going to get the money against delivery and so on. So the cooperative comes back, kind of trying to balance the interest halfway. And what did the aggressive say? It's not good enough. Says either $100,000 or nothing. 5 cents a pound, hop. 15 cents a pound, take it or leave it. That's 3 cents a pound more than his client's highest demand. Take it or leave it, either 15 cents or nothing. So the aggressive says, no, you got to stay out here. In my opinion, there is not a remote chance that there will ever be a contract here, at least as long as the aggressive is involved, because no matter what, his ego is never going to allow, his expectations are clear out in this territory. His ego is never going to allow him to go clear back into the middle there. And so I think he would torpedo the deal before he would, before his ego would allow him to go down. So I think there's no chance of an agreement, and he's lost the opportunity for his client. Now, other comments or questions? Are we sort of together that far? If we are, then the question is, what do you do? What do you do if you're an aggressive negotiator to keep from going too far? And more particularly, what do you do if you're a cooperative negotiator and you're faced with someone who is that tough and who is going to try to push you? And how do you ever take a stand without causing an impasse that would simply destroy the negotiation? So let's turn to that now. That would be the most important remaining thing we have to do, and see if we can lay out the strategy that is now recommended by, clearly the majority of negotiation strategists now believe there is a recommended solution, and it's called tit for tat. And I need to give you something on the flip charts here that isn't included in your material, and see if you can find a blank page to write it down. And it's a little bit technical. I'll ask you to stick with me for just about 5 or 10 minutes while we lay it out, because it's crucial to understanding the way the recommended strategy unfolds. The reason I can lay it out up here is negotiation strategists for about 30 years have been vigorously debating the question of how you stop an aggressive opponent and how you make the most money. You use cooperation or aggression to make the most money. And the negotiation strategists, some of them are diplomats, some are economists, some are lawyers, some are military conventional warfare strategists, some are nuclear deterrence theory strategists. And these people in different disciplines have had to find ways to communicate across disciplines. The way they do it is to find models that capture the dilemma, but that go across disciplines. The model I'm about to show you is called Prisoner's Dilemma. And some of you have probably done Prisoner's Dilemma in college. And this is the economic version of Prisoner's Dilemma. And it assumes two players, A and B, who negotiate multiple rounds. And every round, there's a payoff for A and a payoff for B. And if we want to track the community's interest, we could say there's also a payoff for C, which stands for the community. And the reason this prisoner's dilemma fits our interest right here is because they play prisoner's dilemma with a card. On one side of the card, it says cooperate. On the other side, it says be aggressive. And each round, each player decides whether to turn the cooperative side up or the aggressive side up. And here are the possible combinations. On one particular, any given round, A might play cooperatively, and B also play cooperatively. In that event, A wins $3, B wins $3, and the community is enriched 3 plus 3, which is 6. On some other round, it could be that A turns the cooperative side up, B plays the aggressive side. in that event, A gets zero. The cooperation against aggression loses. The aggressive gets $5, which is the highest payoff in the game. And the community gets 0 plus 5, which is 5. And then the other combination that might be on some play that A plays aggressively and B also plays aggressively. And if they both play aggressively, A wins a dollar, B also wins a dollar, the community gets 1 plus 1, which is $2. Now, interestingly, all of the important negotiation strategists have had to confront this dilemma because they agree it captures the dilemma of cooperation versus aggression. And the most important work until recently was done by the researcher named Savage, that I mentioned, the Savage Regret. It's John Savage. And Savage's insight was to say, the trouble is you never know what your opponent's going to do. But, he said, suppose you did know. Suppose you knew in advance. Suppose you were B, for example. And you knew in advance that your opponent, A, was going to play cooperatively the next move. Against A's cooperation, should B play cooperatively? Or against A's cooperation, should B play aggressively? And the objective here is to win as much as you can. So what would you do? Play aggressively. And so that was also Savage's conclusion. If I knew for sure my opponent were going to play cooperatively the next move, I would move aggressively. That would maximize. Then he said, suppose I knew the opposite. Suppose I were B, and I knew that the next move, A, were going to play aggressively. Against A's aggression, should B play aggressively and they each get a dollar? Or against A's aggression, should B play cooperatively and give the opponent $5 and get zero himself, and then he could see that, no, you wouldn't do that. So clearly, if you knew that A were going to play aggressively, you would have to play aggressively as well. And then the beauty of it struck him. Of course, you never know whether your opponent will be cooperative or aggressive, but look, either way, the sure thing solution is to play aggressively. And to play aggressively all the time against opponents became known as Savage's sure thing solution. And it was a sure thing for only a short time because as soon as that conceptual breakthrough occurred, everybody started playing aggressive all of the time. If everybody plays aggressive all of the time, you limit yourself to a dollar per round and you get minimum outcomes instead of maximum. And so what happened for 20 years in the negotiation strategy was variations on Savage's sure thing in which you deceive your opponent and entice them to cooperate. And as soon as they get cooperating, you whack them aggressively as many times as you can so they get mad and play aggressively. And then you say, why are you attacking me? Well, you started, well, I didn't mean to. Well, let's cooperate. Get them cooperating, and you whack them again as many times as you can. So it's kind of disorderly during that time. And finally, a researcher by the name of Axelrod. And if you only read one other book, you should read this work by Axelrod. Axelrod at the University of Michigan decided that rather than have all these discussions in the literature, he would sponsor a contest and invite the leading negotiation strategists to come and compete using this version of Prisoner's Dilemma and see who would make the most money. 13 aggressive strategists immediately accepted the invitation because they were eager to show they could make the most money. The cooperative strategists didn't want to attend because cooperatives have always had a twofold position. They've always said, we make more money. Cooperative strategy is more profitable. But even if it isn't, it's morally superior. And so Axelrod said, yeah, but we're not going to count moral superiority. We're just going to count dollars. So only one the cooperative strategist attended. So 13 aggressors plus one cooperative. There were 14 who competed in the first tournament. To everyone's astonishment, the cooperative negotiating strategy made more money than any other negotiator. And that turned the whole theoretical world on its ear. These 13 strategists said, foul, we reject the results. It could only happen once in the history of the world. So Axelrod did whatever you and I would do, and that is he published the results of this contest, and he held a second contest. This time, invited strategists worldwide, 63 strategists competed. 62 of them used variations of Savage's Sure Thing aggressive strategy. Only one of them, the same person, Anatole Rapoport, competed using what is called the tit-for-tat strategy, a very sophisticated cooperative strategy. To everyone's astonishment, that strategy made more money than any other strategy in the competition. So suddenly, there's been a reversal of the assumption. And in any games or negotiations where joint gains are possible, it is now granted that tit-for-tat is the more powerful strategy. Now, the strategy is all laid out, I believe, on page 108. Yes, page 108, and it is deceptively simple, so we'll have to work at it a little bit. But notice that at the top of page 108, it says, tit-for-tat, the strategy. Tit-for-tat always begins cooperatively, then responds tit-for-tat to each cooperative or aggressive move by the other side. Now, let's see if you've got it. Suppose I'm an unknown opponent. You are going to be a vigilant tit-for-tat strategist. You don't know what my first move is going to be. What is your first move? Cooperative, because tit-for-tat always begins cooperatively. So you begin cooperatively, I begin aggressively. What is your next move? Aggressive, because you tit-for-tat, whatever I did, you do that the next move. Suppose I'm not very smart, and so we move aggressively, say, for five rounds. On the sixth round, I catch on, and I cooperate. What do you do the very next round? You cooperate because you do tit-for-tat. Okay, now, you know, the critics say that's a stupid mechanical response. Well, where is the wisdom in that? And the wisdom is in the six qualities here. And let me explain them and invite you to annotate them as we go, because it's very it's the heart of what we have left to do here. So the first thing would be to say that tit-for-tat begins cooperatively. A better way to say that is that tit-for-tat is conditionally open, conditionally willing to cooperate. And then to solve the major weakness or major exploitability in the cooperative approach, we have number two, that tit-for-tat retaliates perfectly, and which means tit-for-tat is vigilant. It is vigilant and provocable. So you might want to write in, retaliate perfectly means you got to be vigilant to recognize when you're attacked, and you need to be provocable. That is willing to retaliate when attacked. Now, any fool can retaliate. Tit-for-tat does it perfectly, and it requires three qualities. You must retaliate, be vigilant to see an attack. When attacked, you retaliate immediately. To have the most effect, you need to immediately respond, and to do it unambiguously, so that you are very clear in communicating, you just attacked me, I'm retaliating to the attack. Now, if you do it immediately and unambiguously, there's a danger of overdoing. And so the third quality is you need to do it appropriately. Do it in the proper measure. You don't underreact and you don't overreact. So you're vigilant and provocable. Now, number three, it's perfectly trustworthy. Now, and that means it never moves aggressively unless attacked. Now, let me say that if you're a cooperative, you'll want to follow that rule. What about if you're naturally aggressive? I would say if you're naturally aggressive, go ahead and try attacking and see what happens. If your opponent is cooperative and a patsy, you can make a lot of money by attacking. But you've got to be careful not to go too far. Because the one thing you can make more money out of the aggressive strategy is against a cooperative who isn't provocable. So you see if they're provocable. But tit for tat would not do that. Tit for tat is perfectly trustworthy. Now, number four, tit for tat forgives perfectly. A better way to say that is don't hold grudges. So what if the aggressive beat up on you? Once you see it and you retaliate, there's no need to keep retaliating. Once the aggressive is willing to deal cooperatively with you, don't hold grudges, which means you forgive immediately, unambiguously, but of course appropriately.
This is the end of tape 5, side 2. The program continues on tape 6.